of the special fascinations of the movies is that because they're the youngest of the art forms, we're still in the presence of the founding fathers, as it were, the giants who invented the language and the alphabet, who discovered what kinds of stories movies could tell and what kinds of themes they could explore. Alfred Hitchcock, Jean Renoir, Charlie Chaplin, and Fritz Lang. Fritz Lang, who was born in Vienna in 1890, made his first film more than 50 years ago. And his futuristic fantasy Metropolis in 1927 established him as one of the innovative geniuses of motion pictures. And M, his documentary-like study of a child murderer, confirmed his genius. He fled Germany for France and then for America. And his sardonic, tough, unsentimental, and thrilling American movies include Starlet Street, Woman in the Window, Manhunt, The Ministry of Fear, Clash by Night, and one of the best of them all, which was also his first American film, a study of mob violence called Fury. He's one of the most honored directors of all, and he's influenced young filmmakers on at least two continents. His hallmarks are his range, his choice of themes, and his vigor. Joining me to talk with Fritz Lang is Philip Chamberlain, the curator of film at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, where he's done a marvelous series of retrospectives on the great directors. Mr. Lang, I'm curious, what was the first movie you ever saw, and what persuaded you that you ought to become a movie maker?
That's a long story. You see, I ran away from home, as I think every decent human being should do. I think the famous generation gap existed always. I couldn't understand me with my father, and I ran away. I wanted to become an artist. My father was an architect, and when you hear always at lunchtime how lousy the business is, how can you expect that you should become the same as your father? But anyway, so I went to Brussels, and I tried, looked at every museum which was possible, and I have to mention it, in spite that I hate to talk about my personal life. I had an affair with a very beautiful Eurasian girl, and when it was too much for me, my friend took me and shipped me to Bruges, where I came to. I never saw her again, and there I was sitting and painting, and painted and painted. And on a Sunday, I went to a open place where they sell coffee and beer, and there I saw my first film. It was a film about a peasant revolt in France. I forgot the name. I didn't have any ideas that I would like to make films, and I sat one day there behind my tripod and painted. So a man came and said, look, would you paint for me? I said, certainly. I was very proud, you know, about my big art. And he said, look, it cost you a lot of money, the paint, and where you paint it on, I will give you an old painting, which doesn't matter very much, and you paint your landscape over it. I said, fine. I did it for 2 or 3 months, till somebody tipped me off. Namely, they sent this film, these pictures, to the United States, and then said, look, we want to warn you. This is just a painting, an old painting, painted over by a modern painter. Wash the modern thing off, and you will get an exact old painter. And the police did it, and then it was established in the United States as a valuable thing. And then they could sell it. So when I heard this, I ran away from Bruges and went back for a short time to Munich, where I was working in the master class of Julius Dietz, and then I went to Paris. Definitely decided I wanted to become an artist. For a whole year, I lived on painting postcards and such kind of things. And I traveled the whole Mediterranean and in Asia, and I came up to Bali. And then I turned back, and then I really started to work. I lived on Montparnasse, on Montmartre, and I painted on Montparnasse. And there, one day I went to a movie, and I saw something which interested me very much, namely a moving picture. I painted static pictures. And there I saw, I think the director was Fayard, and at these days they showed picture about famous crooks, famous in literature, you know, Arsène Lupin, Rocambole, and Fantomas. And I stayed there till the war broke out. And I left Paris with the last train. I had some adventures which are not important. It would take too long to tell you here. I was arrested on the frontier, but I escaped and I came back to Germany. And then I went to war. I was wounded different times. And in the year 1918, I had the war up to here. And then it turned out that I should have never been in the trenches because my eyesight was so lousy. So I stayed in the back country, and I was one day sitting in a coffee house, and I had a very beautiful, excuse me again, very beautiful sweetheart, and I racked my brain from where to get enough money. I had 120 kronen as a wounded, I had become an officer during the war. And suddenly a man came to me and said, "Would Herr Leutnant agree to play a part in a play, in a stage play?" And I was very arrogant and looked around at him and said, "Who are you?" I was sitting on a corner of a billiard. And he said, "My name is Ostermeier, and I'm a director of the play which is sponsored by the Red Cross called the HEERS." So I said, you can't help that, so what do you want from me? So he said, "Well, we would like that you play a part." And I said, "You know, sometimes in my life, very seldom, I have bright moments. And this was one of the bright moments." And I said, "How much do you pay?" And he said, "750 kronen. I had 120. My heart stood still. But as I said, it's a bright moment, and I said, "That's not very much." And he said, "We couldn't pay more than 1,000. So I signed. Now started the trouble for this poor man, because I have never been on a stage, and I had written screenplays before. I was working before the war started in a cabaret. And when I have seen the films in Paris, I had decided I wanted to become a motion picture director. Mm-hmm. When I had sold the films which I just mentioned, and I saw one of them, it was something which I didn't like, which I would have done quite differently. And so when I was now working in this play for the Red Cross, I talked with one of the sponsors, and he said, "Look, I want you to meet a man called Erik Pommer." Erik Pommer, who became afterwards a very good friend of mine, was really one of the greatest men in motion pictures which I ever met. And I wore a monocle on this eye, no, on this one. And this was very nearsighted. So he looked at me and he said to his friend, "With this arrogant son of a bitch, I don't want to talk." He said, "Look, I promised already." He said, "All right, I will listen to him, but nothing doing." So after the show was over for the Red Cross, I sat with him. And the show was not over. We sat together till 4 o'clock in the morning. And when it was over, I had a contract as the head of the writing department, something which is called in Germany dramaturgist.
And story now, editor. In a
what?
A story editor. In American terms, I should think.
And then I went to the regiment and said, look, I can't do anything anymore. I cannot go back to the trenches anyway. I was decorated. Can I have some months vacation? He said, yes, certainly, 2 months. It was at the end of 1918. So I was free. I went to Germany, and the German company of Erich Pommer, the Dekla, had promised that I shouldn't worry about anything. They would do everything, that I had nothing to do with the military thing anymore. So I went to Germany, and I started to work, and I was very happy.
And Pommer was sort of the producer of this.
Yeah, he was the head of the company. He owned Dekla. Mm-hmm. About the producer, I have to talk later to you, because a producer, what you are used to call a producer, came to life much later. Mm-hmm. And after 2 months, suddenly I got a letter from the regiment to come back. Otherwise, I would be court-martialed.
You were AWOL,
yeah.
You used to say. Yeah.
And now I started to find out what did they do, and they haven't done anything to get me rid. And I was just ready to go back when the revolution came in Germany. And so I could stay there. It was now beginning of November 1918. And I had the advantage that I was already in the business. And so I started writing films. And then one day I wrote films at nighttime for 4 nights, and I wrote a finished a film. And then I never liked what the directors did. And then one day I wrote a film which was called Half Cast. And Erich Pommer said, I said to him, look, I sell it to you, but only if I can make the direction. So he said yes. And that was the first film which I did in 4 days.
You had a very long and happy association with Pommer, didn't you?
Yeah. He was really a great, great man. He was, what shall I say? I think that when I say he was an industrial captain, that doesn't say it again. He was much more than a producer. And he was a friend of all the people with whom he worked. As a producer, or what you now call a producer, I will tell you a story about him. I made a film, I think it was the first success I had was Destiny, then was the Dr. Mabuya, then came the Nibelungs. And in the Nibelungs was a scene where over a hill top, 400 Huns should come, wild, outbreak of Asiatic people. And one day after shooting, Eric came to me and said, Fritz, I want to talk with you about this scene. I said, yeah, what's it about? And he said, look, 400 people and horses and makeup and everything, it will take a long time, it cost a lot of money. Is this scene necessary? I said, let me think it over. I went home and thought it over, and 2 days later I said to him, Eric, I don't think that we should make the scene. We cannot make competition to American mass scenes. I will drop it, we'll have another idea. And Erich Pommer said, no, I thought it over too. I think the scene is too important, we should make it. That is what Erich Pommer was. And I dare you, call me one producer who would have done it.
Yeah. Well, the Germany of the early 20s, when you were beginning in film and making the Nibelung and so on, was an extraordinary period. It was the greatest period of German cinema, and you were one of the sort of ornaments of it. How does it happen that there was a sudden flowering of the German cinema in the early 20s?
Don't forget, it was something absolutely new. For me, and I think for Erich Pommer too, I cannot talk about other people. For me, film is the art of our century. I think it is the art because before that, one didn't have an audience for whom you could produce something as expensive as a motion picture is. A theater speaks to hundreds of people. A film speaks to millions. And it was something absolutely new. We started from scratch. Don't forget, Germany had no contact with the United States. We didn't see any American films. We saw some Swedish films from Sjöström. But nothing that was to copy. And when we had an idea, or when we followed a script, you see, we had to do everything for ourselves. There was no, what you have here, no lab who made tricks for you or such a thing. We had to make the tricks in the camera. And we invented everything. And therefore, it became, what shall I say, so personal, our life, that it was our life. And we walked, I walked like a sleepwalker, straight ahead. I didn't ask anybody, and Pommer was wonderful. I never had any fights with him. He never wanted to change anything. And I said, I walked like a sleepwalker. I knew the things which I do. I believed in the things. Nobody said, you have to watch out for money or such a thing. You know, and this was the inflation when I made the Nibelungs. It was a big inflation in Germany.
Well, could you say that those very conditions, and maybe even the fact that Germany had economic problems, which in a way forced you to improvise and to get involved in all the different aspects of production, that very fact developed a personal cinema and developed a much more control and artistic relationship with each of the angles in a film,
Look, that is very possible, but don't forget, the inflation was over in 23 or 4.
Well, you'd already made Die Spinnen and Dr.
No,
Mabuse.
Well, look, I had already, The Spinnen was one of my first films. I know you like them. Look.
Well, Dr. Mabuse, too. I had
The Müde Tod, the Trois Lumières. And then I had made, it was my first success, my world success, and then the Dr. Mabuse, and then the Nibelungen. And it was something else, no. Look, in these days I had an idea. I wanted to show the German people, when I made Destiny, or the Müde Tod, was a romantic German. The Dr. Mabuse was the German immediately after the war, the inflation time, when everything was terrible, when on the walls of Berlin were suddenly posters, a half-naked woman dancing with a skeleton, and it stood there, Berlin, you are dancing with death. And then I made the Nibelungs, which was for me the legend, the German legend. And then I made Metropolis. There was a German being in the future. Then I made Spies, which was the German of today. Then I made The Girl in the Moon, which was the first rocket flight. And so we had an impulse to do certain things, not for Germany, but for a new art.
You had a very tight team around you. Didn't you work with the same people on many of the films, and you had a...
I had a crew, and that is one thing, you see. For example, in Metropolis. And don't forget, we did not have a trick department, as it is in the United States. For example, the creation of the robot. It was done by a cameraman called Ritter. Naturally, we talked about it. I said, look, when you create the robot, I want to see, suddenly, it's still all metal, but you see already a leg. or the heart start to pump. That's fine, but he has to transpose it into motion picture language. And I think what he did with rings, lighted rings going up and down and so on, that is something which is still unique today. And the same thing is with tricks in the Nibelungs. Or let me say, when I made the first film which I mentioned, which was a world success, not in Berlin, but this I can tell you later, the Müde Tod, where I had a lot of tricks which had to be made in the camera. By the way, Fairbanks Senior bought the film afterwards for $5,000 and copied all the tricks 10,000 times better, naturally, as we did it.
Douglas Fairbanks Senior.
Yeah.
Really?
And then he made The Thief of Baghdad, mm-hmm. with the flying carpet and all the things which I had already in this film. No, but you know, when the film was finished, it was called in Germany Der Müde Tod, meaning dead is weary, tired. So naturally, please forgive me, I have to attack the press now. One of the reporters wrote in a famous paper, the tiring death, death tiring the audience. So naturally the film was cancelled after 2 weeks. And we, Eric Pommer had a relationship to Paris, and we sold it to Paris. And in Paris, and I have to excuse myself when I talk about praise which has been given to me. In Paris, we had reviews. This is the German film which we always hope to see. Out of this film speaks the soul of Dürer, of Grünewald. And when these reviews came back to Berlin, then the Müde Tod was shown again.
All the critics looked again and said,
and it became the
wow, I see. Well, I saw some stills not long ago from The Woman in the Moon or The Girl in the Moon, and your rocket was really amazingly prophetic, wasn't it? You had...
Shall I tell you one thing? Some days ago, I found a book written by a dead friend of mine, by Willy Ley. And in this book, I found out that what we did in 1928 or 9, the flight curves and the rocket was exactly what Apollo 8 did. And Willy Ley wrote that when I showed in 1929 pictures out of the capsule to the moon, it was exactly the same thing which the astronauts shot on the flight in Apollo 8.
Remarkable. I'd like to see the whole film again. I suppose the verdict of history to this point is that M is your greatest film. Is it your personal favorite?
Look, it's very hard to say. Usually I would give you the answer, if a mother has so many children, which one do you like the best? No, but I will tell you why it is so hard to say. If you make a film, and the film suddenly is acclaimed as something very big, you naturally are very happy. I made here the first film, Fury, an anti-lynching film. And I was very happy when it was a success. And other films too. And I really couldn't tell you if I like M the best. And I couldn't even tell you if it is my best pictures. And on top of this, I shouldn't be the judge of my pictures. You too, you should judge, not I.
Well, perhaps even more than us, it's the audience that judges. I know, for example, that...
Aren't you audience?
Yes, of course, but only a small part. But it's a simple fact that M, more than any other film which has ever been made, was the most frequently shown film in the film societies and colleges and universities in a poll that was taken just a few years ago. I think it was something like shown like 40% more than any other film that it was in popular demand by these film society programmers. I don't know whether that means that the film enthusiasts were the ones that wanted to see it and show it to their clubs, or whether it was the demand springing from...
Now, what is your point?
Well, my point is that the verdict is clear. M is a very popular film, a very contemporary one, one that gets across to people. I wonder what incident led you to make it? What was the impetus to get that film made?
I tell you one thing, it is very peculiar. You mentioned before The Girl in the Moon. After I finished Metropolis, I made my own company. And the first film was The Spies, which can be seen in this country. And the second one was The Girl in the Moon. The release at the UFA, and some of the higher echelon went in these days to the United States, and it was the first time when sound was invented. And they came back and they asked for me to put some sound into the film. Now they had the release, and practically they have nothing to say. So it was against my theory. It would have, in my opinion, spoiled the style of the film. Would have spoiled the style of a silent film. So I said no. So UFA said, if you don't do it, we break the contract. So they didn't pay anything anymore. I had a lawyer who told to me, you have to live up to your contract. Otherwise, you will lose. So I had to give them two actors which I had under contract. One was Gerda Maus, who is dead by now. And I had to give my whole crew. And amongst them was a man who built the dragon, really a genius, and architects and so on. About 9 or 10 people. And UFA thought they could starve me out, but they couldn't. And I was sick and tired about motion pictures, and I wanted to become a chemist, and didn't make any films anymore. And there came a man whom I usually wouldn't have greeted on the street. He was a so-called independent producer, and he wanted to make a film with me. I said, no, I don't want to make any films anymore. And he came and came and came and came.
But you were really on the verge of leaving filmmaking.
Yeah. I didn't want to make any films anymore. 9 months I had to be quiet. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't make another film because I had to give all
UFA
my...
UFA was the giant in the industry at that time.
So finally, when he didn't leave me alone, I said, all right, I will make a film for you. But... you have only to give the money, that's all. You have no right to say to the script, no right what kind of film I want to make, no right about the cast, no right whatsoever. When the film is finished, you have no right to cut. Yes, Mr. Lang, yes. Otherwise, M would have never been made. Because who would have made in these days a film without a love story? I tell you a story about Irwin Thalberg. Irwin Thalberg has seen the film. I wasn't in America in these days. And he wanted to show it to his people, to his writers, to his directors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he showed it to them. And he said, now, what do you think about this film? And they said, yes, we like it very much. It's an outstanding film, etc., etc. And finally, one writer said, Mr. Thalberg, may I ask you a question? And he said, yes, what? And the writer said, Mr. Thalberg, what would you have said if I would have come with such a script to you? Mm-hmm. And Thalberg had always pieces of gold in his pocket. And did this. And then he said, well, I probably would have said to you, go to hell. So you see, yeah. I don't think that if there would have been other circumstances, that the man wanted definitely to make a film, because I never had a flop in these days. Not one flop.
What if you'd taken the idea of a movie M about a child murder.
Yeah.
To UFO, they might have had objections themselves, might they not?
They couldn't because I had a contract. Yeah, wait a minute. Certainly, they would have had objection to it because they would have said there's no love story and so on. I would have never known. I tell you, originally, it was not the story of a child murderer. I was married to Thea von Harbou in these days, and she wrote practically all my German films. And we discussed the most heinous crime. And we came of writing anonymous poison letters, you know? Yeah. And we started to work on it. And one day, I don't know what made me do it. I said, wait a minute. I think I have another thing. A child murderer. A man who is forced by some urge, by some perverted urge, forced a sick man to kill. And she agreed with me. And then we switched the whole thing. And there is one thing which I want to say. At this time, there was a mass murderer in the Rhineland called Kürten. And all the reporters thought that we got the idea from him. But it is not correct because he killed children and men and women. And the script was finished before they caught him. And then they made the script and that is that.
Well, one of the things that is interested me about M is that you never see Laurie murdering anyone. The violence is all suggested.
Look, you hit here something, you're hitting on something which is a hobby of mine. I am very much against violence in motion pictures. Look at M. All what you see when the child is killed is that the ball rolls out and comes to a stop. And that's a balloon that the murderer, Peter Lorre, has bought for the child, comes up, hits a moment the telegraph wires, and then disappears, and you know the child is dead. If, and let's forget that it would have tasteless and tactless, and that many people would have closed their eyes, let me assume for a moment it would have been possible to show one way what this perverted mind has done with the child. It is only one way, and many people would have been disgusted. But by not showing this kind of violence, everybody in the audience could now think the most horrible thing which they had in mind, the most horrible things that happened to a child. And by this way, I force them to help me and to have a feeling which I never could make them have if I would have shown one single case. And another thing, I think by showing too much violence, which happened here in this country, it happens that people get so used to violence that they don't know anymore. Look at the Westerners. The shootout at the end is the only solution. There is no other solution as to kill somebody.
No? Yes, you get the impression from all the violence that is the only solution to problems.
You cannot talk somebody out of it. You can only kill him. And that is the end.
Yeah. Well, how did you find Peter Lorre? That was his first film, I think.
It's very peculiar. Peter Lorre was an unknown actor. He came from, you know, Vienna is on the borderline of Hungary. And there he was acting in Germany it's called Stegreiftheater, improvisation theater. You know, you tell an actor this and this happened, but he has to make up his own dialogue. Mm-hmm. And then he came to Berlin and had success in two Wedekind plays, and I saw him. And because he was so different from what in these days people thought a murderer has to look, you know, bushy eyebrows and so on. So I cast him in this thing. And it was the first film he ever made. And there's a very, very funny thing. You know, Peter Lorre has a daughter. She's 18 years old now. Nobody knows it. And she's a hell of a good actress. And she's here in Hollywood. And she's just waiting for somebody to give us the same chance I gave her father.
Fascinating. How did you come to use whistling? Interesting idea.
I don't know. I really, look. What you call the whistling now, or what I usually call a directorial touch. I had once an interview in France, and I said, when a film is finished, a director should be psychoanalyzed in his own interest. I cannot tell you why I use this kind of whistling. I cannot tell you why I make a directorial touch. I have an idea, it clicks somehow, I believe in it, and I do it. Why I really do it? From here, not from here. Only a psychoanalyst could tell me when I finish the picture.
It's funny to see, peculiar to see a film that's been around for a while now, because sometimes you can lose its place in history, particularly with a film like M, which seems so contemporary. Yet I have my impression is that the documentary flavor of M was startling in its time.
Yeah, but wait a minute.
Is that true?
I think that is very important. Look, I think it is very important in a film. Look, the story of M is a child murderer is sought by the police and the criminals in a town. He is caught, period. It's a very simple story. If there are stratas in audiences, in which I don't believe, I love audiences. And I never understood how anybody can say an audience is stupid, has a child of a, has a mind of a child of 15 years or 8 years, I don't know. I don't understand. Look, it is a cop and robber story for people who don't want to think. It is a story of police procedure and of criminal gangs on a higher strata. It is a story of a man who hates himself because he does certain things, a sick man who has an urge to do horrible things. And in the last analysis, it is a film against capital punishment. Because at the end, if you remember, the one mother said, what does it help? That doesn't bring our children back to life. We have to watch our children much better. Now, the main thing of a story is, aside from the idea, the director, in my opinion, should be a man who doesn't want to adjust himself anymore to certain things which in our society today he is forced to adjust them almost every day. He shouldn't adjust himself to government fees, meaning that the government has the right to keep certain things secret from the people who pay the people who do the things, or the irresponsibility of big corporations, or, you see, the computer-directed establishment who has no feelings because it is directed by a computer. So the director should not adjust himself to anything. He should put the finger, let me say, on a social evil, on a social discrepancy. He cannot help it, but he should point it out. Now, what happened? This should not be the main theme. It should happen to the actors, to the heroes, and to the hero and the heroine. If this happened, I will show you what happened. Maybe a man and a and his wife go to the movie. Costs $3 per person is $6. The parking lot, $1, is $7, and they didn't have a drink. So they go home, and suddenly there is something, and the husband says to his wife, do you remember there is this one thing where they talk about this government, that the government, it should influence her? And she says, yes, I didn't quite understand. And the husband starts to explain it to her. So she says, oh no, I think you have made a mistake. So they start to fight, and then finally result is that they say, well, we have to see it a second time. Now, they are interested in my ideas, that is my standpoint. And from the standpoint of the financier, they go a second time and they pay a second time $6.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that interests me very greatly about M and its authenticity is the beggars organization,
yeah,
and which becomes a sort of third force in the plot, and also the underworld as a whole. That sounds very authentic. It looks
kind of... I'll tell you one thing. In these days, I have to go again back. I apologize for that. When I have made these big films, I mean, with great costs and with many extras and big buildings, like the Nibelungs, like Metropolis, like Woman in the Window, I had it up to here. And I became much more interested in human beings. And in these days, I was working with the Scotland Yard of Berlin, which was Alexanderplatz. And I have seen many, many cases of murder almost immediately. And if you see such a thing, you can understand why most policemen are for capital punishment. I am against capital punishment for a very, very simple reason. Because we force the one who throws the switch or who pours the poison thing into, yes, the room, we force him to commit the same crime for which we kill another one. For this reason, I'm against capital punishment. I don't think that anybody has a right to kill anybody. So this became more and more an obsession with me. And naturally, I wanted to know the other side of the coin. And I met a lot of people better who belonged to certain crime organizations. As a matter of fact, I was a member of the pimp organization. I swear you, I never pimped. Anyway, I met many people. And I saw their side of the crime. And I could understand many, many things which somebody who has not the chance, or in my case, the good luck, to see all these things. I had a better insight, you know. Or for example, you talked about the beggars. What you see in M is correct. We had a beggar exchange where the beggar brought the things which they got and sold it to make a living. So I knew all the things out of my own experience. For example, when I made M, do you remember the kangaroo court? I went to my, and I can honestly say friends, and I said, look, children, I would like to have in the first row sitting all of you.
These are real underworld figures.
Yeah.
Yes.
And five or six of the criminals said, no, we can't do it. We would love to do it, Fritz, but we have never been photographed. And we cannot afford to be once photographed. But the other one came. And they were sitting, when you look at the kangaroo court, on the left side. And it happened when I was shooting, that suddenly one of them came to me and said, Fritz, we have to leave. I said, what happened? They said, I'm told the police comes out of here. I said, when will the police be here? Oh, in 50 minutes, an hour. I said, can you stay 15 minutes? They said, yes. I shot two short scenes, which I still had to shoot. They went, and when the police came, I said, I don't know. What do you want? I don't know. Nobody was here. You know,
Nobody here but us filmmakers.
Look, I tell you one thing. M is a very peculiar thing about things that really happened and so on, you know.
What was its early reception, its initial reception? Was it well received right at the beginning? Was it an instant success?
I tell you one thing. Maybe it's interesting for you. You know, we had censorship. Censorship by elderly people. And Thea and Harbo and I, we were sitting there for 2 hours. You know, not like people who had done something. No, but like schoolboys who have made some homework and are waiting for a good or a lousy grade. And after 2 hours, they came out and they started to say, Mr. and Mrs. Lang, this film shows everything which we are opposed that should be shown in a picture, but it is done with such an honesty and with such integrity that we don't want to make one cut.
M, I think, was 1931.
Yeah, 30 or 31, I'm not sure.
The Germany was changing for the worst around you even then, I should think. Phil, you showed me an article from a French newspaper which recalls sort of the circumstances of your leaving.
Yes, it was a little later. It was a couple of years later after he'd made the testament of Dr. Mabuse. And this article is a fascinating one. It appears in a French journal, and it deals with an offer. Here it is, Fritz. It deals with an offer which Goebbels made.
It is from L'Aurore.
Right.
It is a princess.
It's a fascinating story. Would you tell us about that, Fritz?
Yeah. Look, I don't know what you are wondering about this whole thing. You know, I found out that many people have forgotten what freedom means. When I came, 1934, in this country, it was the land of the free. And I learned here about a song which was sung at the start of the century. And it goes, freedom doesn't come like a bird on the wind. Freedom doesn't come like a summer rain. Freedom is a very hard-earned thing, and every generation has to earn it again. What would have all the things which Mr. Goebbels offered me to do? What could all the money help me if I wouldn't have had my freedom?
As I gather, the testament of Dr. Mabuse had really infuriated the Nazis.
Look, I had put into the mouth of an insane criminal Nazi slogans that Hitler has said. And one of the slogans was, we have to achieve that the average citizen destroy violently the authorities which he himself has created and break them down. And on the rubbish of the ruins, we will create our realm of 1,000 years. That was the doctrine of the Nazis. And my insane criminal said the same thing, only, and on the rubbish, on the ruins, I will create my realm of crime. So I was sitting in my office when brown shirts came in, and they must have heard about this whole thing. And they said the film would be confiscated. That was very hot, eh? And said, if you think that you can confiscate a film by Fritz Lang, well-known director of Europe, do it. Well, they did it. So the company was naturally worried about it, and they wrote a lot of things to Goebbels, and one day I got an invitation, call it an invitation, an order to see Mr. Goebbels. So in these days, you had to have striped trousers, and a cutaway and a stiff shirt, you know, and you had the invitation, you know, here. And you went there. It was in the Ministry of Propaganda. And I walked in, and immediately was a big desk and brown shirts with the guns on right and left. Now, what do you want? I said, well, here. Oh, invitation to Mr. Goebbels. Okay, Go down this corridor, the second to the right. Okay, I walk down there. Long corridors, very high ceilings, paved with cement squares. When you stepped with your shoes on them, the echo came down from the bare walls, you know.
Like a set from Siegfried.
No, not a set from Siegfried. They were adorned with something. They were not adorned with anything. And they come around the second, and again a desk. And the same thing, three or four times. And finally you have the feeling you never come out here anymore. And I had a very bad conscience because of the scene which I just told you about, the scene of the changed Hitler speech. Well, finally I came to a kind of a octagonal room, and the door opened, the secretary came out and said, Mr. Lang? I said, yes. Please, will you wait a moment? Oh, I waited. And then the door opened, he said, please enter. It was a big room with four or five big windows on a big place outside. And on the far end was a desk, and Goebbels came with black trousers and the Nazi uniform, and he came on with a stretched out hand, you know, he was limping, as you know, and he could turn on the charm like a faucet, like from a faucet, you know. And I was thinking, now we will see what he has to say. And he never mentioned, never with a word, the scene. But finally he started to talk that the Führer has seen my films, and I was listening, said, what does he want from me? And I couldn't forget, you know, all my walking around in this. And finally he said, your Führer has seen your films, and he has said, this is a man who will make us the Nazi film. In this moment, I was wet all over my body. Perspiration broke out. And I had only one desire, out of here. Get out of here, somehow.
What was making you so nervous at that
point? What?
What was making you so nervous at that point?
No, wouldn't you be nervous if Mr. Goebbels said to you, what shall I answer him when I was opposed always to the Nazis? Yeah. I say you have forgotten what freedoms means. Yeah. Well, anyway, what could I say? If I would have said no concentration camp, so I said something the equivalent of I'm tickled pink. And he started to talk and to talk, and I said, how do I come out of here? I cannot stay in Germany anymore. How do I get my money back from the bank? And outside of the window, there was on this big place a street clock on a high pole, something which you don't see here anymore. I think it's downtown somewhere. And I looked it, and the hands went down, you know. And I knew at 2 o'clock or 2:30 the banks were closed. I couldn't get my money that way. How do I get out of here? And Goebbels talked, and I always said, fantastic, and I'm tickled pink, and I don't know what. And he talked and talked, and he talked about actors and everything. And I became more and more perspiring and so on. And only at the end, and by now the hands were going and going, and I saw it was already too late to go to the bank. And he said something, he never mentioned the quotation. He just mentioned, because in the film, in the Testament of Dr. Mabuse, the insane doctor goes back and becomes insane again, the man of the institution.
Yes.
And he said, that is wrong. He should be killed by the fury of the outraged mob. And I said, it is wonderful. Oh, Mr. Herr Propaganda Minister, it's a great idea. So we, I went out, went to the bank, was too late, it was closed, and the same evening I left and went to Paris and never came back, except in 1957.
You went back in 1957?
57, the first time.
Uh-huh.
Just on the day when Brecht died, Bertolt Brecht. Then I went to Paris and I met Lilium there. Mm-hmm. In 1934 I came to this country.
Well, your first film here was Fury, as we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
What I find astounding is that from a standing start, you knew so much about the feeling of America. How did you discover America so
quickly? I'll tell you one thing. I was bought over by David Selznick. In these days, it was chic to bring a famous person from Europe, and as I was famous by my films, and I couldn't do anything anymore in Europe. And for a year, I was there and didn't get a job. I had one job. He's a very good writer, and we wrote a script together, and David Selznick liked it very much. That was before Christmas. He came to my house and congratulated the writer, was Oliver Page Garrett, and myself. But it was on the 23rd of December. On the 26th, it was the lousiest script which I have ever seen. It was never made, anyway. And for a whole year, I didn't have to do anything. So I never spoke German anymore. I tried only to speak English. If somebody spoke to me and he started to grin, so I started to laugh because I thought he would now say something funny. And when I had time, I talked with a lot of people. I read a lot of comic strips. I went, for example, and I lived for a month with the Navajo Indians and the Hopi Indians. And there I found out certain things about the Westerner, you know. And the Westerner are the only legend which the Americans have now. When they make Westerns, that's this filming of legends, of American legend.
Did you have trouble in Hollywood in the sense that your view of life is tough? It's, you deny that it's black, I guess, but it's really, it's tough and sardonic. And
yeah, but it's not sardonic, it's not black. It is only honest. Look.
At a time when Hollywood was not always making honest movies, perhaps. Did you find yourself sort of having difficulties? That's what I'm asking, really.
A director is a very peculiar thing. When people come to me and say, how do you become a director? It's very hard to say. You cannot learn to be, in my opinion, you cannot learn to be a director. Look, a director has to know how a queen walks, how a prostitute talks, how somebody of the establishment talks, how a schoolboy talks. He must know everything about life. He must be interested in life. He must love people. If he doesn't love people, if he doesn't try to understand what makes them tick, he cannot direct. You know, that's, maybe that is the answer for what you asked me.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Fritz Lang.